Picture this. You've got a top producing broker. We'll call him Felony Phil.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So Phil is a smooth talker. He brings in millions in revenue, absolute star of the firm. But over the weekend, Phil makes a terrible decision. He goes out, drinks way too much, gets behind the wheel, and gets hit with a felony DUI conviction.
It's a terrible situation.
Yeah, really bad. But here is the critical question for you, the listener. A DUI has absolutely nothing to do with stocks or bonds or customer money. It is not a finance crime. So does Phelan's weekend mistake legally ban him from ever working in the securities industry again? Just keep that scenario in the back of your mind because the answer is going to completely change how you view financial regulation.
It really exposes the underlying machinery of how this whole industry is policed, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Before we pull back the curtain on that machinery, though,
Yeah.
this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 24 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Yeah, they're great.
All right, let's get into the deep dive. We are tracing the regulatory life cycle of a broker-dealer employee today. This is a massive part of the Series 24 exam. We're tracking the journey from the moment someone applies for a job through the background checks, licensing exams, daily supervision, all the way to the day they walk out the door, and, well, as we'll see, the years after they leave, too.
Right. And we need to lay down a foundational rule for anyone studying this material right now. If you try to brute force memorize the timelines, the forms, and all the acronyms, the Series 24 is going to be a miserable
Oh,
experience.
absolutely miserable.
The true cheat code for passing this exam is understanding the why. AVASE, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, they don't just invent rules to create paperwork.
Right.
Every single regulation we are going to talk about today is essentially scar tissue.
Wow, scar tissue. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, a rule exists because at some point in the past, somebody exploited a loophole or stole money or blew up a firm. Once you understand the specific risk FINRA is trying to neutralize, the answers to the hardest exam questions actually become intuitive.
I want to focus heavily on that why today, because
Yeah.
that's how this stuff actually sticks in your brain. To start, we have to establish who FINRA actually cares about. Think of FINRA's jurisdiction like an incredibly strict, highly regulated nightclub. The bouncers are at the door and they are checking IDs. Our first big hurdle is figuring out who is actually inside the club and who has access to the VIP section. This brings us to FINRA Bylaws Article 1, Paragraph R, the two-step test for registration.
This concept is the bedrock of the entire exam. I mean, almost every personnel question on the Series 24 starts by testing whether you know the difference between an associated person and a registered person.
Right, people mix those up all the time.
Colloquially, people use those terms interchangeably, but legally, they are worlds apart. Being an associated person means you have crossed the velvet rope. You are inside the nightclub.
Okay.
FIRA has jurisdiction over you. They can investigate your emails, they can subpoena you, they can fine you. But, and this is vital, being an associated person doesn't automatically mean you have to take a licensing exam.
Right. So being associated gets you in the door. Being a registered person gets you into the VIP section. Registration means you are actively engaged in the securities business of the firm. You're advising clients, executing trades, supervising the floor. That is when you have to start carrying specific licenses.
Exactly.
So, step one of this test, who qualifies as an associated person? The bylaws cast a remarkably wide net, right? It includes every sole proprietor, partner, officer, director, or branch manager of the firm.
It also includes every natural person engaged in the investment banking or securities business who directly or indirectly controls or is controlled by the member firm. And it pulls in every single employee of the member firm unless they fall into a very narrow clerical exemption, which we will dissect later.
Let's test this in the real world with a scenario. Listener, I want you to pause whatever you're doing and actively think about this one. Imagine a guy named CFO Carl.
Okay, CFO Carl.
Carl is the chief financial officer of the broker-dealer. He has a massive corner office. He dictates the firm's budget. He has total policy-making authority. But Carl hates dealing with people. He stays in his spreadsheet cave.
Right.
He has never once spoken to a retail customer. He never touches a trade ticket. Based on what we just laid out, is Carl an associated person? And part two, does he need to register? Give it a second. Make a call in your head.
So the answer is that Carl is an associated person, but he absolutely does not need to register.
Let me push back on that, though. If the guy is literally the chief financial officer, making decisions that affect the entire firm's viability, how on earth is he allowed to operate without a license? Isn't that a massive blind spot for the regulators?
It sounds like it, until you look at the mechanics of the two-step test. Step one, is he associated? Yes. Because he has policymaking authority, he is a control person. He is officially inside the nightclub. Feminora wants jurisdiction over the executives calling the shots, because if the firm goes bankrupt due to Carl's bad budget, Feinora needs the legal authority to investigate him. So they cast the net and pull him in.
Got it.
But step two, is Carl engaging in the investment banking or securities business? Is he pitching stocks or structuring mergers? No. He's managing the firm's internal corporate finances. Because he doesn't touch the securities business itself, Feinora doesn't require him to pass a Series 7 or Series 24.
That makes sense. The trap on the exam is assuming that power equals registration. It doesn't. Registration is triggered by the activity of doing securities business, not just your spot on the org chart.
Yeah.
But association is triggered by control. If a question asks, must this person register, it's a trick. It is really asking you two distinct questions. First, are they associated? Second, are they doing the business? Fail either test, and they don't register.
This nuance also extends to something called common control affiliates, which is a highly testable area. Imagine a massive financial conglomerate. They own a broker-dealer, but they also own a separate real estate company.
Right.
If someone works for that real estate sister company, they don't work for the broker-dealer. However, because they are under the same corporate umbrella, you know, under common control, if they have the power to influence the broker-dealer, they can be pulled into that associated person definition.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Feinora doesn't let you hide behind sister companies.
So the jurisdiction net is massive. Now that we know how wide Feinora casts that net, we need to talk about how firms actually screen the people walking through the door. You can't just let anyone into the club. Let's move into the pre-hire process. We're talking background checks, fingerprinting, and the central document of a broker's career, the Form U4.
The pre-hire process is a massive area of focus for Feinora examiners because it directly touches on the firm's supervisory obligations. When a firm hires someone, they have an affirmative duty to investigate that applicant's good character, their business reputation, their qualifications, and their experience.
Right.
And this investigation has to happen before the firm submits the Form U4 to register them.
Wait, I can see a firm arguing, look, we gave the applicant the form, we told them to fill it out truthfully under penalty of perjury. They lied to us. That's on them, not us. Does Feinora buy that defense?
Absolutely not. Feinora explicitly rejects that defense.
Why?
Because people lie. People omit things. An applicant might conveniently forget about a tax lien from 4 years ago or a customer complaint at their last job. The firm cannot act as a passive mailbox.
You need to actively check.
Right. The firm written supervisory procedures, their internal operating manual, must mandate a search of reasonably available public records. You have to verify the claims.
And there are specific timelines attached to that verification, especially if the person is an industry veteran hopping from one firm to another.
Correct. If the applicant was previously registered with another Feinora firm, the hiring firm is legally required to pull and review their most recent Form U5. Which is the termination notice from their last job within 60 days of the new application.
Right.
If the applicant is coming over from the commodities or futures side of the industry, the firm has to review the CFTC Form 80, which is the equivalent document for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. You have to know how they left their last gig.
So you have the paper trail covered. But what about the physical trail? Let's bring in a new character to illustrate the SEC fingerprinting rule. Listener, I want to introduce you to back office Betty.
I love Betty.
She's great. Betty works in the windowless basement vault of a massive broker-dealer. She is surrounded by filing cabinets and stacks of physical stock certificates. Betty is a quiet person. She has literally never seen a retail customer in her life. She doesn't even have an external phone line on her desk. Based on her complete lack of customer interaction, does back office Betty need to be fingerprinted? Pause and think.
Mm-hmm.
Do you need fingerprints to sit in the basement alone?
Yes, she absolutely does. And this is where the exam will try to lure you into a false sense of security. The test for the fingerprinting requirement has absolutely nothing to do with whether you are customer facing.
It's all about access, isn't it?
Precisely. The SEC rule mandates fingerprinting for anyone who has access to securities, customer money, or the original books and records of the firm.
Wow, okay.
Why? Look at the risk. Betty works in a vault with physical stock certificates and bearer bonds. She might never speak to a customer, but she has the physical capability to slip a bond into her purse and walk out the door. The SEC wants her fingerprints on file with the FBI so that if things go missing, they know exactly who is in the room.
That makes perfect sense when you frame it around the physical risk of theft. Is there anyone at the firm who is exempt from being fingerprinted?
The exemption is incredibly narrow. It applies only to personnel whose duties do not involve securities in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, like who?
We are talking about the facilities management team, the cafeteria workers, the building maintenance staff. But if you are a stock transfer clerk, a cashier handling incoming checks, or an IT admin who has unrestricted access to the digital ledger of customer funds, you are getting printed.
Let's talk about record retention for those fingerprints, because the series Cut Before loves testing the timelines of how long you have to keep paper. When Betty eventually retires and leaves the firm, how long does the firm have to hold on to her fingerprint records?
3 years after termination.
Let me stop you there, because I want to understand the why. Why exactly 3 years? Why not 5 or 10?
It aligns with the statute of limitations for many SEC record-keeping violations and routine regulatory examination cycles. The regulators want a 3-year buffer. If an audit uncovers an embezzlement scheme 2 years after Betty leaves, the regulators need to be able to pull her historical fingerprint cards to cross-reference with evidence. 3 years ensures the trail doesn't immediately go cold the day an employee resigns.
Okay, 3 years post-termination for the fingerprint records of people you actually printed. But what if the firm filed a formal notice claiming an exemption for the janitor? How long do they keep that piece of paper?
That exemption notice must be kept for the life of the firm.
Really?
Yeah. As long as the broker-dealer exists, they have to prove why they didn't fingerprint that specific role.
Fascinating. So fingerprints are physical security. Now let's dive into the biographical security, the Form U-4 itself, the Uniform Application for Securities Industry Registration. When I first saw U-4, I was shocked by how invasive it is. It captures everything.
It really does. It requires your personal history, employment history, residential history, every exam you've ever taken, and a massive disclosure section.
Yeah.
And all of this data is fed into the CRD, the Central Registration Depository. The CRD is a computerized database maintained by FINRA, but it's used by other self-regulatory organizations, you know, SROs and state regulators as well. It is essentially your permanent record in the financial industry.
And here's where we hit our first major numbers game for the exam. The Form U-4 asks for your residential history and your employment history, but they require entirely different look-back periods. Listener, I use a very simple memory hook for this. Write this down. 5 homes, 10 jobs. The U-4 requires 5 years of your residential history and 10 full years of your employment history.
5 homes, 10 jobs is the perfect way to anchor it because the exam writers love to invert those numbers. They will throw a multiple choice option at you suggesting you need 10 years of residential history.
Which is false.
That is false. And there is a logical reason for the difference. 5 years of residential history is generally sufficient for legal purposes.
Mm.
If someone needs to serve you with a lawsuit or verify your tax jurisdiction, 5 years of addresses is plenty.
Right.
But 10 years of employment history, that is designed to reveal patterns. If you've been fired from 6 different financial firms in the last decade, FINRA wants to see that entire trajectory.
And the employment history doesn't just mean finance jobs, right? It means everything. If you're a barista for 6 months between hedge funds, you have to list a coffee shop. No gaps.
Exactly. Any gap over 3 months usually triggers a flag and requires an explanation. But the truly intense part of the U-4 is the disclosure section.
Oh, yeah.
This isn't just about whether you've been convicted of a crime. You have to disclose prior regulatory actions, civil judicial injunctions, customer complaints, and financial events like personal bankruptcies, compromises with creditors, or outstanding tax liens.
Let me play devil's advocate here. Let's say a customer gets mad because the market crashed. It wasn't my fault. I didn't do anything wrong. They just lost money and filed a baseless complaint. Does a totally baseless complaint have to go on my permanent CRD record?
Yes, it does.
Wow.
The disclosure obligation is incredibly broad. The U-4 asks if you have ever been the subject of an investment-related, consumer-initiated complaint that alleged compensatory damages of $5,000 or more, regardless of the outcome.
Regardless of the outcome. That's wild.
That FMINRA isn't just looking for proven guilt. They are looking for smoke. If one broker has 20 baseless customer complaints and another broker has 0, FINRA wants the data to investigate why that first broker is generating so much smoke.
Okay, listener. If you are zoning out, washing dishes, or walking the dog, reset your attention right now. The rule we are about to cover, the 10 versus 30 day rule for amending the Form U-4, is arguably the highest probability test question in this entire section. It is guaranteed to be on your Series 24.
I completely agree. A principal's job is not just to file the initial U-4, but to keep it accurate. When information on that form changes, the firm has a legal obligation to amend it. Let's start with routine changes.
All right.
Say you move to a new apartment or you get married and change your legal last name. The firm must file a U-4 amendment promptly, but no later than 30 days after learning of the change.
30 days for routine administrative updates.
Yeah.
Got it. But what if the change is not routine? What if the employee just triggered a statutory disqualification, an SD event?
If the event triggers a statutory disqualification, which we are going to unpack deeply in a few minutes, but for now, think felony convictions or regulatory bars, the timeline shrinks dramatically. The firm must file that U-4 amendment within 10 days of learning of the event.
10 days. That is a massive operational difference for a compliance department.
And again, look at the why. If an administrative assistant takes 30 days to update a broker's new home address, there is zero systemic risk to the financial markets. But if a broker is convicted of criminal fraud on a Tuesday, 30 days is far too long to let them continue trading customer accounts without regulatory intervention. FINRA demands to know about disqualifying events immediately, hence the 10-day rule.
10 days for SD events, 30 days for routine. Do whatever you have to do to lock that in your brain. Oh, and before we move off the U-4 entirely, there is a very specific legal mechanism buried at the bottom of that form, the pre-dispute arbitration clause.
This is a critical piece of industry mechanics. When you sign a Form U-4, you are signing away your right to sue your firm or your colleagues in civil court for most employment disputes. You are agreeing to binding arbitration.
Okay.
But the exam tests a specific supervisory duty here. Whenever an associated person signs a new U-4 or acknowledges an amended U-4, the firm has an affirmative obligation to provide them with a separate written statement explaining exactly what that arbitration clause means.
Ah, so you can't just hide it.
Right. You can't just bury it in the fine print. You have to explicitly disclose that they are giving up their right to a trial by jury.
Okay, so back to our narrative. Back office Betty is fingerprinted. The U-4s are filed. The 30-day routine updates are chugging along. But Betty is in the vault. Who is actually allowed to supervise the trading floor?
Yeah.
Who has the VIP badges? This brings us to the structure of registration categories.
A few years ago, FINRA completely overhauled the qualification structure to make it more modular. Today, if you want to be a registered representative, you have to pass two exams.
Okay.
First, a foundational core knowledge exam called the Securities Industry Essentials, or the SIE. Second, a specialized top-off exam that reflects your specific job function.
Let me throw out an exam trap right here. Listener, let's say a college grad passes the SIE exam. They have the certificate on their wall. Can they legally sit down, pick up the phone, and sell a single share of stock to a retail customer? Pause. The answer is absolutely not.
Right. The SIE is not a standalone registration. You are not a registered rep just because you passed the SIE. It is a prerequisite. To actually conduct business, you need the SIE plus the relevant top-off exam.
Okay.
If you want to sell general securities, you need the Series 7. If you want to do investment banking, you need the Series 79. The top-off dictates the scope of what you are legally allowed to do.
And this modular scoped approach applies to supervisors too, which is the perfect time to introduce our next recurring character. Everyone, meet Generalist Gary.
Oh, Gary.
Gary's an ambitious guy. He just passed the Series 24 exam. He is officially a general securities principal. Gary walks into the firm on Monday morning feeling like an absolute titan. He thinks the Series 24 is the master key to the universe.
What dangerous mindset.
Very. He thinks he runs the broker-dealer. So Gary decides his first act as a principal is going to be taking over the supervision of the firm's complex options trading desk.
And Gary is about to get his firm hit with a massive failure to supervise violation.
Why? He passed the principal exam. Why can't he supervise options?
Because the Series 24 is a broad general license, but FINRA explicitly carved out highly specialized areas of risk that it does not cover. Think about options trading. The risk profile is nonlinear. A naked call option has infinite theoretical risk.
Sure.
Supervising that requires deep, specialized mathematical and strategic understanding. The Series 24 doesn't test that deeply enough. So, to supervise options activity, Gary would need to sit for and pass the Series 4 exam to become a registered options principal.
Okay, so compliance taps Gary on the shoulder and says, "Back away from the options desk. You don't have a Series 4. Gary is annoyed, but he pivots. He marches over to the accounting department. He says, I'm the principal. I'm going to review the net capital calculations, and I'm going to sign off on the Hufkenius reports.
And again, Gary is shut down. The Phocius report, the financial and operational combined uniform single report, is the vital financial health check a firm submits to Fenner and Nathalie. It proves the firm has enough liquid capital to survive. Calculating net capital is an incredibly complex accounting exercise.
And Gary doesn't know how to do it.
Right. A Series 24 does not qualify you for that. That role is reserved for the financial and operations principal, known as the FINUP, which requires the Series 27 exam.
Or the Series 28, right?
Right.
Let's differentiate those.
Good catch. The Series 27 is for carrying firms that actually hold customer funds and securities. The Series 28 is a slightly lighter version for introducing firms that rely on a clearing broker to hold the assets. But either way, Gary Heary's 24 doesn't cover it.
Gary is furious at this point. He feels useless. He storms over to the research department, grabs a draft of a new equity research report about a tech stock, and says, I am the general securities principal. I am officially approving this content for publication.
Strike three for Gary. Approving the actual content of a research report requires a supervisory analyst license, which is the Series 16. The Series 24 principal can approve the distribution of the report to make sure it meets general marketing rules, but they cannot approve the technical content or the valuation models inside it without a Series 16.
I look at the qualification structure, like a video game skill tree.
Yeah.
Passing the Series 24 unlocks a huge portion of the map. You can supervise equities, corporate bonds, mutual funds. But there are specific doors you cannot open without the exact key. You want the options door? Series 4. The accounting door? Series 27. The research door? Series 16.
That is a highly accurate mental model. And this modularity ties directly into a foundational FENRA requirement, the two principal minimum. Every FENRA member firm, unless they are a pure sole proprietorship, must have at least two officers or partners registered as general securities principals.
Okay, so a firm needs two Series 24s. But wait, if they have an options desk, they obviously need a Series 4. Does the Series 4 count as one of the two mandatory principals?
This is a classic exam trap that trips up a lot of people. The two principal minimum is a floor, not a ceiling. The rule requires two general securities principals, period. If the firm also conducts an options business, it needs a registered options principal in addition to those two, unless one of those Series 24 principals happens to also hold a Series 4. FINRA mandates two general principals to ensure continuity.
So it's about making sure someone's always there.
Yes. If a firm only has one principal and that person gets hit by a bus, the firm technically has to halt all business because there is no one legally allowed to supervise the reps. The two principal rule is a redundancy requirement.
Redundancy is key. Okay, so Gary finally stays in his lane. The firm has its two principals. The reps have their Series 7s. Let us talk about the people who aren't licensed at all, specifically the clerical and ministerial exemption. We briefly mentioned this earlier.
Right. Associated persons whose duties are solely and exclusively clerical or ministerial are exempt from registration. We are talking about file clerks, typists, human resources staff, and IT help desk employees who maintain hardware but don't operate trading systems.
Let's illustrate this with our fourth character. Listener, meet receptionist Rachel. Rachel sits at the front desk of the branch office. She answers the main phone line, she signs for FedEx packages, she directs foot traffic. Her role is purely clerical. She does not need a Series 7. But her exemption from registration operates like a highly sensitive laser tripwire in a museum. If she steps 1 millimeter over the line, the alarm sounds, the exemption vanishes, and she is suddenly acting as an unregistered broker.
The line is drawn at exercising judgment or discussing the business. If Rachel recommends a security, provides investment advice, or tries to explain the performance of a mutual fund to a waiting client, she trips the wire.
But the ultimate tripwire, and the one the exam loves to test, involves taking a customer order. Let's set the scene. Listener, I want you to evaluate this. Rachel is at the front desk. The phone rings. It issues Mrs. Johnson, one of the firm's biggest clients. Mrs. Johnson says, I am in a massive rush. I need to buy 1,000 shares of XYZ stock right now. Is my broker Dave available? Rachel looks over, and Dave's in the bathroom. Can Rachel just write down buy 1,000 shares XYZ in a sticky note and hand it to Dave when he gets out? I mean, come on, she's just acting as a conduit, right? She's being helpful.
If you apply common sense, you'd think, yes, she's just taking a message. But if you apply FINRA logic, the answer is that she just triggered a massive violation.
Really? Just by writing it down?
If she takes that note, hands it to Dave, and Dave simply enters the trade off the note, Rachel just shattered her clerical exemption. By accepting the specific details of a trade to be executed, she acted in the capacity of a registered representative.
So what on earth is the protocol? Is Mrs. Johnson just out of luck until Dave finishes washing his hands? Is there any way Rachel can write that down without breaking federal securities laws?
There's a very specific, incredibly narrow exception for transcription. For an unregistered person to transcribe an order, three precise conditions must be met.
Okay, what are they?
One, the registered person must be physically unavailable. Two, the unregistered associate must transcribe the details verbatim. They cannot interpret, they cannot exercise judgment, they must act like a human tape recorder. But condition three is the absolute kicker. The registered rep must promptly contact the customer to confirm the details of the order before it is entered into the trading system.
So the sticky note isn't an order ticket, it's a callback request.
Exactly.
Dave comes out of the bathroom, looks at the sticky note, and before his fingers touch the keyboard, he must pick up the phone. Hi, Mrs. Johnson. Dave here, confirming you want to buy 1,000 shares of XYZ at the market. If Dave skips that phone call and just executes the trade, Rachel broke the law by accepting the order.
MRA allows transcription as a tightly controlled failover mechanism, not as a workaround for secretaries to take orders. The confirmation call transfers the liability and the execution authority back to the licensed professional.
Okay, so Gary got his Series 4 to supervise options. Rachel transferred Mrs. Johnson to voicemail to avoid the tripwire, and everyone is operating within their proper scope. How do they keep those hard-earned licenses active year after year? Welcome to the wonderful world of continuing education.
Continuing education, or CE, is a major focus of the Series 24 because tracking it is a core principal duty. The CE landscape is divided into two distinct buckets, the regulatory element and the firm element. The exam expects you to know who builds the curriculum, when the deadlines are, and the exact penalties for missing them.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison to keep it clean. On the left side, we have the regulatory element.
The regulatory element is completely standardized. The content is designed by FINRA and the CD Council. It covers broad regulatory changes, compliance updates, and ethical standards. It is delivered digitally through FINRA's FinPro system. And as of a major rule change in 2023, every single registered person must complete the regulatory element annually by December 31st of every year.
Let me stop you. I've been in this industry a while. Didn't it used to be tied to your licensing anniversary? Like you did it in your second anniversary and then every 3 years after that?
It did. And that is exactly why the exam tests in the new rule so heavily. They want to make sure you aren't operating on outdated information.
So they changed it.
Right. The old periodic anniversary cycle was an administrative nightmare to track. FINRA modernized it. The anniversary cycle is dead. It is now a hard, universal annual deadline, December 31st, every single year.
And it applies to each registration category you hold. So let's look at General Scary. Gary holds a Series 7, his Series 24, and now his Series 4 for options. Does he just take one generic CE course for the year?
No. FINRA maps the CE to the licenses. Gary will have to complete modules relevant to a general securities rep, a general principal, and an options principal. The curriculum expands based on the number of badges you carry, but it all has to be done by December 31st.
Okay, that's the regulatory element.
Right.
On the right side, we have the firm element. How does that differ?
The firm element is not standardized by FINRA. It is a written training plan designed and executed by the member firm itself. The firm must evaluate its training needs and update the curriculum at least annually.
So FINRA dictates the what for the regulatory element, but the firm dictates the what for the firm element. Why does FINRA give firms that flexibility?
Because every broker-dealer is fundamentally different. A boutique firm that only sells municipal bonds faces entirely different risks than a massive firm executing algorithmic high-frequency options trades.
Right.
The firm element requires the firm to conduct a needs analysis based on its size, its structure, its scope of business, and its customer complaints, and build a training program that targets its specific vulnerabilities.
Makes sense. And firms can be somewhat efficient here, right? Can they overlap their required training?
They can. Firms are allowed to integrate their required anti-money laundering, you know, AML training, and their annual compliance meeting into their firm element curriculum. It doesn't waive the requirement, but allows them to satisfy multiple regulatory obligations with one cohesive training block.
Okay, listener, here's your exam trap alert. I'm going to put our expert on the spot. Expert, let's say it is January 1st. I was busy over the holidays. I completely forgot to log into FinPro. I missed the December 31st deadline for my regulatory element. What happens? Am I fired? Is my registration instantly terminated by FINRA?
No, your registration is not terminated and you don't have to retake your licensing exams, but you are immediately placed in a status called CE inactive.
CE inactive. break down what that actually means for my daily life at the firm. Can I just keep working and catch up on the modules over the weekend? And maybe the firm just holds my paycheck until Monday.
Absolutely not. CE inactive is a severe operational penalty. The moment you hit that status, you are legally prohibited from performing any activity that requires registration, and you cannot be compensated for any registered activity.
Oh, okay.
You cannot talk to customers, you cannot enter trades, you cannot advise on portfolios. And to answer your specific question, no, you cannot accrue commissions while inactive and have the firm pay them out later. The spigot is turned off entirely.
So I'm effectively benched. But here is the nuance I want to clarify. Am I still an associated person?
Yes, and that is the exact nuance the exam tests. Being CE inactive strips you of your VIP privileges, your ability to do registered work, but you do not get kicked out of the nightclub.
Right.
You remain an associated person under Fionare's jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. You are still subject to all the rules. The firm still has to supervise you. You just can't do the job until you complete the modules and clear the flag in the CRD system.
Let me throw a pattern interrupt at you. A surprising scenario that catches people off guard. Let's talk about permissive registrations. This happens when an executive or maybe someone moving to a purely administrative role keeps their license active just in case they need it later. They aren't actively acting as a broker, but they hold the license permissively. Do they get a pass on the annual CE requirement since they aren't dealing with the public?
They do not. FINRA does not recognize light or fake registrations.
Yeah.
If your firm permissively registers you, you hold the license, full stop.
And no exceptions.
Therefore, you are subject to every single rule that applies to a registered person, including completing the regulatory element by December 31st. You want the badge, you do the homework, there are no free rides.
Okay, so missing a CE deadline gets you benched. But what happens when an associated person doesn't just forget a deadline, but actually breaks the law? This brings us back to the hook of our deep dive, phase five, the timeout box, statutory disqualification, and heightened supervision.
This is perhaps the most critical risk management area for a Series 24 principal. A statutory disqualification, or SD, is not just a demerit. It is an entry bar. It is FINRA's ultimate red flag, signaling that an individual poses a severe systemic risk to the investing public.
Let's bring back our character from the beginning of the show, Felony Phil. Phil got convicted of a felony DUI over the weekend, a terrible choice, a tragedy waiting to happen. But as we discussed, it has nothing to do with finance. So let's answer the question we opened with. Does a non-financial felony trigger a statutory disqualification?
Yes. It absolutely does. Under the Securities Exchange Act, any felony conviction within the past 10 years triggers an automatic statutory disqualification.
Any felony.
It does not matter if it was a DUI, assault, or stealing a car. The exam writers will aggressively try to trick you here. They will write a paragraph explaining how the felony was totally unrelated to the broker's job duties, trying to convince you that it shouldn't count.
Don't discount.
Do not fall for it. 10 years. Any felony. Automatic SD.
Any felony triggers it. But what about misdemeanors? Are they treated the same way?
No, misdemeanors are treated fundamentally differently. A misdemeanor only triggers an SD if it is specifically related to finance or honesty.
Okay, like what?
The rule says it must involve the purchase or sale of a security, bribery, burglary, embezzlement, fraudulent conversion, misappropriation of funds, or perjury.
So the nature of the crime dictates the regulatory response. A misdemeanor for simple trespassing or public intoxication, not an SD, but a misdemeanor for embezzling $500 from a local charity bake sale.
That embezzlement misdemeanor triggers a statutory disqualification. Even though it's a minor crime in the eyes of the criminal justice system, it involves misappropriating funds. Senate RL looks at that and says, if this person will steal $500 from a bake sale, we cannot trust them with a client's retirement account.
And the timeline, the 10-year look-back period. When exactly does that clock start ticking? Is it the date the crime occurred, the date they were released from prison?
It is the date of conviction. That is another exam trap. If someone commits a crime in 2015 but isn't convicted until 2018, the 10-year clock starts in 2018.
Okay, so Phil has an SD on his record because of the felony DUI. The law says a statutorily disqualified person cannot associate with a broker-dealer. It's a bar. So Monday morning, does the firm just have to fire him on the spot and walk him out by security?
It operates as a presumptive bar, yes. But the firm doesn't necessarily have to fire him if they believe he can be rehabilitated and supervised safely. A firm can effectively beg FINRA to let Phil stay. To do that, the member firm must file an application called Form MC-400.
Let's drill into the mechanics of the MC-400. Who exactly files that? Does Phil hire a lawyer and file it himself?
No, the member firm files it. The firm is the applicant. Phil is merely the subject of the application. The firm has to notify the SEC, and then the application is reviewed by a specific body within FINRA called the National Adjudicatory Council, or the NAC.
The NAC.
Right. The NAC holds immense power here. They review the nature of the crime, Phil's history, and the firm's proposed supervision plan, and they decide whether to grant relief and let Phil stay in the industry.
So the NAC is the jury. And if the firm itself was disqualified, say the broker-dealer as a corporate entity got hit with an SD event, what form is that?
That would require form MC-400A. But for individuals like Phil, it's the standard MC-400.
Assuming the NAC reviews the MC-400 and actually decides to grant relief, they don't just say, okay, Phil, welcome back, try to behave. They attach massive restrictive strings to that approval, right?
Incredibly heavy strings. If the NAC approves Phil, he will immediately be placed on what is called heightened supervision. And this is not a casual agreement. This is a highly formal, meticulously documented structural commitment by the firm.
Let's dive deep into heightened supervision. This is exactly what a Series 24 principal has to manage. What does a heightened supervision plan actually look like in practice? Let's say our boy Generalist Gary is assigned by the firm to be Phil's designated supervisor.
If Gary is named as the designated supervisor in an NAC-approved plan, here is the most critical exam trap regarding his role. Gary generally can have no other supervisory responsibilities that conflict with or distract from his supervision of Phil.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. In many strict plans, Gary cannot manage a team of 50 other reps while also trying to watch an SD person. The principal supervising an SD broker must be laser focused.
Because the risk of Phil relapsing into bad behavior is so high, Gary has to essentially shadow his every move.
Exactly. The written plan will dictate rigorous daily or weekly transaction reviews of every single trade in Phil's accounts. Gary will have to physically or digitally sign off on those reviews. Gary will have to pre-approve any new account Phil tries to open. He will have to pre-approve every piece of marketing material, every email, every letter Phil wants to send to a customer.
Are there restrictions on the actual business Phil can conduct?
Often, yes. The plan might state that Phil is permanently barred from trading options or penny stocks, or that he cannot hold any discretionary accounts where he makes decisions without talking to the client first. The NAC builds a fence around him.
Where does this master plan live? Does Gary just keep a Word document saved on his desktop to remind him what to do?
If a FINRA examiner finds out Gary is managing this off a random Word document, the firm is going to get skewered. A heightened supervision plan must be embedded directly into the firm's written supervisory procedures, the WSPs. It must become part of the firm's official operating manual, customized specifically for Phil.
So what happens if time passes? Let's say it's been a year. Phil has been a model employee. Gary gets a little lazy. He stops pre-approving Phil's new accounts because, hey, Phil knows what he's doing now. What is the regulatory fallout of Gary dropping the ball?
The fallout is catastrophic. A heightened supervision plan is a legally binding commitment to the regulator. If Gary fails to follow the exact steps written in the WSPs, Gary is going to be hit with a personal failure to supervise charge, which could cost him his principal license.
Yikes.
The firm gets hit for a systemic supervisory violation. And as for Phil, because the conditions of his MC-400 approval were violated, the NAC can revoke the approval, booting Phil from the industry entirely.
Wow. Incredibly high stakes for everyone involved. Okay, so let's play this out to its logical conclusion. Let's say Phil actually does mess up again. He violates his product restrictions, Gary catches it, and the firm's management says, that's it, we tried, but Phil is too much of a liability, you're fired. How does a broker-dealer formally cut ties with a registered representative? This takes us to the exit interview, Form U-5 and the two-year tail.
When an associated person leaves a firm for any reason, the firm must formally sever the registration by filing Form U-5, the Uniform Termination Notice.
And what is the deadline for filing that U-5?
The firm must file the Form U-5 within 30 days of the termination date, and they must provide a copy of that U-5 to the terminated employee within that same 30-day window.
30 days. And they can't just check a box that says he doesn't work here anymore, right? They have to explain the context.
Yes. The U-5 requires a specific reason for termination. The categories are voluntary resignation, discharged, which means fired for cause, permitted to resign, which usually means quit before we fire you, deceased or other. If a firm selects discharge or permitted to resign, they have to write a detailed narrative explaining exactly what the employee did wrong.
Okay, here is my favorite analogy for FINRA's authority. FINRA operates remarkably like a regulatory mob boss.
A mob boss?
Yeah. Just because you quit the family doesn't mean you escape the family's reach. You cannot just resign to avoid an investigation.
That is a darkly accurate way to conceptualize it. Filing the Form U-5 severs the employment relationship, but it does not end FINRA's jurisdiction over that individual. Under FINRA Bylaws Article V, FINRA legally retains disciplinary authority over a former associated person for 2 full years after the effective date of termination.
2 full years? Why so long?
Think about the mechanics of financial fraud. It takes time to unravel. If Phil was churning a customer's account, trading excessively just to generate commissions, the client might not realize it until they get their end-of-year tax documents.
Well, that makes sense.
If the client complains in December, but Phil was fired in January, FINRA needs the legal authority to drag Phil into an arbitration hearing or ban him from the industry, even though he hasn't worked there for 11 months.
So the 2-year tail prevents a guilty broker from just saying, "I quit the moment." Compliance starts asking questions, thinking they can magically escape punishment.
Exactly. The resignation doesn't stop the clock on FINRA's ability to investigate and punish conduct that occurred while they were associated.
But let's separate FINRA's authority from the firm's responsibility. FINRA has a 2-year window to discipline Phil. But what about the firm's duty to keep his record accurate? Let's say Phil is long gone. It has been 5 years since he was fired. The 2-year FINRA disciplinary tail has expired. Phil is working in real estate now. Suddenly, the broker-dealer receives an audit letter conclusively proving that Phil embezzled $50,000 from a client's trust account during his final month at the firm. Does the firm just throw the letter away because he's been gone for 5 years?
No, they do not. And this is a massive high-level exam trap. You have to separate the two concepts. FINRA's retention of jurisdiction to discipline the individual ends after 2 years. But the firm's duty to amend the Form U-5 disclosure questions has no expiration date.
No expiration whatsoever.
None. If the firm discovers misconduct that occurred during Phil's employment, even 5, 10, or 15 years after he left, the firm is legally obligated to file an amended Form U-5 updating his disclosure history.
I want to make sure I grasp the why here. If FINRA can't fine him anymore because the 2 years have passed, why force the firm to update the paperwork 5 years later?
To protect the integrity of the CRD system, which protects the next employer and the public. That amendment places a permanent black mark on Phil's historical record. If Phil ever tries to re-enter the securities industry 10 years from now, or if he tries to get a job at a bank, or if a background check is run on him, that embezzlement disclosure will be sitting there.
Wow.
The public's right to know about financial theft never expires, even if the regulatory statute of limitations on fines has.
That is a brilliant mechanism. Okay, we have covered an incredible amount of ground, and there are a lot of specific timelines floating around. Before we wrap up, I want to do a rapid-fire recap of the numerical traps we covered today. Listener, if you take nothing else away, you absolutely must have these numbers memorized for the Series 24. Let's hit it. Expert, I'm going to throw out the scenario. You give me the exact number.
Ready.
The firm learns about a statutory disqualifying event for a current employee. Deadline to amend the U-4.
10 days.
Okay. The employee moves to a new house, a routine administrative change. Deadline to amend the U-4.
30 days.
An employee is terminated. Deadline for the firm to file Form U-5.
30 days.
And how long does FINRA retain jurisdiction to discipline a former employee after that U-5 is filed?
2 years.
How long does the firm keep physical fingerprint cards after an employee terminates?
3 years.
What is the look-back period for a felony to trigger a statutory disqualification?
10 years from the date of conviction.
Date of conviction, yeah. Right. And finally, what is the hard annual deadline to complete the regulatory element of continuing education?
December 31st, every single year for each registration category held.
10 days, 30 days, 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, December 31st. Write those on a sticky note and put it on your bathroom mirror, listener. You will see them on the exam.
You know, if we take a step back and look at the sheer scale of everything we've unpacked today, the massive web of fingerprinting vault clerks, the 10-year background checks tracing every job you've had, the elaborate MC-400 applications just to keep a job, the lifelong U-5 amendments following you into retirement, it raises a really profound question.
What's that?
What does this intense, almost suffocating regulatory framework say about the inherent temptation for bad behavior in this industry? Think about it. The entire architecture of FINRA is built on the assumption that simply having access to other people's money is a corrupting force. They don't trust you just because you wear a suit.
Right.
They require physical fingerprints, endless disclosures, and an oversight system that tracks you for years after you quit. The rules we study aren't arbitrary bureaucratic hurdles. They are the literal manifestation of every time trust was broken on Wall Street.
Wow. That perfectly ties back to what you said at the very beginning. The rules are the scar tissue of past scandals. FINRA operates on the principle that trust is good, but a two-year post-termination jurisdictional tail and a permanent, unerasable disclosure record is better.
Exactly. Understanding that cynicism is how you master this material.
Trust is good, but a two-year tail is better.
I love that. And that brings us full circle back to our nightclub analogy. FINRA runs a very tight door. The VIP section is heavily monitored. You have to earn your badge to get in. And if you get kicked out, they do not forget your face. That is it for today's deep dive into the broker-dealer employee lifecycle. Thank you for listening. Keep thinking about the why behind the rules. Keep crushing your Series 24 prep, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.